Welcome to City Talks, a new podcast series looking at the big ideas, issues and developments affecting cities across the UK. Each month we'll be discussing a different topic with a panel of city experts. I hope you enjoy the programme. Welcome to this special Election 2015 episode of City Talks. My name is Ben Harrison and in this episode we'll be discussing how and why UK cities are so important to the campaigns of each of the major political parties, how the urban vote could shape the outcome on the 7th of May, and what all of this might mean for the future of UK cities into the next Parliament and beyond. The big debates currently raging on the future of the UK economy and the public finances continue to be dominated by spatial arguments around where growth in the economy is happening and which places face the biggest cuts to their budgets. These arguments resonate strongly within urban areas, particularly fast-growing cities like Brighton and London, where high house prices and congestion are most likely to be felt, as well as in cities like Sunderland, Liverpool and Hull, which are home to the highest incidence of poverty, benefit dependency and unemployment. In response, over the last 18 months we've witnessed a race to the top on urban policy and city devolution between the major political parties, with each keen to demonstrate to the electorate that they are best placed to put more control into local hands and create jobs, raise wages, invest in infrastructure and build homes in cities across the country. So we've had George Osborne declare his intention to create a northern powerhouse with proposals for extensive devolution to Greater Manchester. We've had Nick Clegg launch his Northern Futures project and promise devolution on demand in the next Parliament. And we've seen Ed Miliband and Ed Balls promise a major expansion to the Local Growth Fund, giving UK cities more control over the money that they spend. Given these announcements and the fact that two-thirds of the top 50 target seats identified by the major parties are located in urban areas, will the 2015 general election be won and lost in urban battlegrounds? And does all of this mean we'll see a genuine move towards greater devolution to and investment in UK cities in the next Parliament? To discuss these issues, I'm delighted to welcome Mark Ferguson, editor of the independent grassroots blog Labour List, David Kirkby, researcher for independent think tank and pressure group Bright Blue, and John Elledge, writer at the New Statesman and editor of their sister site City Metric. So, John, to begin with, I'll turn to you first. Can you briefly give us your sense as to why we've seen urban policy rise up the political agenda recently and the impact that you think it's having on the election campaigns of the major parties?
I think there are two main reasons why we're hearing a lot about this issue at the moment. One of which is the economic argument. I think after 30 years of focusing economic policies very much on the south of England, people are finally waking up to the fact that to bring up the average national growth rate, we probably need to make sure that growth is happening in Newcastle and Leeds and Sheffield and so on, rather than merely in sort of London and its satellites. My reading of the situation is that's certainly a very big motivator from the Conservative side, where they've kind of got it into a head that if they're ever going to win majority government again, they need to become competitive in regions of the country where they're frankly not at the moment. So I think there's a sort of long-term plan coming from George Osborne on that one, which a lot of his Northern Powerhouse policy is related to. The other broader reason why we're hearing a lot about this, I think, is the widespread disaffection with the state of the country at the moment and the fact that London and London politicians are getting a lot of blame for that. I think it's all of a piece with the rise of minor parties from outside the traditional duopoly. People want to do things in a slightly different way. People think that politicians in Westminster are not necessarily working in their interests, and therefore there is possibly a hunger for some measure of doing things differently and devolving power to local areas in a way I don't think there's been for several generations.
So you think there is something markedly different this time around then about this kind of rhetoric of pushing power out of the centre? Because I guess a cynic might say that we hear this come every election cycle, and that actually it's something which is very easy to promise ahead of an election, much harder to deliver when you're in government.
That's certainly true. All oppositions are in favour of devolution. All governments are centralisers. And I think that's actually not just about politicians. I think a lot of that comes from the Whitehall machine. I feel it might be different this time, partly because there is clearly such an enormous appetite for it, and partly because of the vast numbers of promises that are being made in advance of the election. I think if this was just a feint, we wouldn't have been hearing so much about it for the last year or 18 months, particularly from politicians like George Osborne, who in the immediate future, I don't think he has an enormous amount to gain for this. This is a very long-term plan from Osborne's point of view. I don't necessarily see it swinging many seats in favour of the Conservatives this time around, but it might in 2025.
So, I mean, picking up on that then, David, I mean, as John said, a big part of the Conservatives' policy agenda in this area is around this northern powerhouse, devolution to Greater Manchester. And as John has said, you know, the Conservatives have struggled to appeal to voters in the north. Just give us your sense as to what the driver for Osborne is on this. You know, is this about the economy? Is it a political strategy that he's employing here? Why has he prioritised devolution to the north?
I think you can look at both political considerations and economic considerations, but maybe if I just focus on the political considerations. So I agree with John that I think in terms of the idea there's going to be a direct dividend for the Conservative Party in Manchester or whatever is not particularly plausible. Mm. But I think you could look at maybe two more indirect, potentially more medium long-term benefits for the Conservative Party. So one would be the fact that the Conservative Party needs to talk about northern cities and talk about them as sources of strength for the country. I think in the past there's been perhaps something of an unfortunate tendency to talk about cities primarily in terms of the problems they represent, you know, in inner cities, crime and so on. And I think it's very important that the Conservatives talk about and are seen to be embracing cities as kind of on their political landscape, if you like. You know, Newcastle, Manchester, Leeds, these are places that Conservatives should be talking about and ensuring that voters are aware that they kind of recognise them and sort of want to be a presence there. I think there's potentially a second benefit for the Conservative Party, again, a kind of more indirect one, admittedly. And that has to do with the way in which when you push power downwards towards people, it potentially can create a greater scrutiny of the effectiveness of public service delivery. When money is being handed down by a very distant state, I think the focus can sometimes shift towards how much are we getting and focus very much upon the amount that's being spent in an area. But when control and responsibility for delivery of, say, services is pushed down to a more local area, that can encourage, I think, on the part of the electorate, a greater scrutiny of effectiveness and perhaps comparison to other areas. And I think that's a force which can potentially benefit the party in the longer term.
Sure. I mean, I'd like to come back to that point about public spending and public service transformation in a moment. But Mark, just to bring you in, I mean, George Osborne's northern powerhouse. I mean, it's put Labour on the back foot, hasn't it? I mean, you know,
unnecessarily so, because the Labour Party has been talking about devolution of power to cities and local authorities for years. Especially since John Curtis has been running Labour's policy review, he has an absolute obsession with this devolution of power from the centre. The idea that you can't pull a lever in Whitehall and, you know, a policy solution drops out in Wakefield.
So what's happened?
I think part of it is that it's difficult to explain to the electorate. Like, all of this is fascinating, but I think that perhaps Liberal Democrats would be the best people to explain that you can bang on about localism and devolving power down to people for years and won't necessarily win you votes. You know, I think it's only fair to say that the Lib Dems have been ahead on this agenda for their own reasons for a long time. But I think one of the reasons the Labour Party is quite torn on this is that there is this this tussle between those who would centralise and those who would decentralise. I think Ed Miliband sort of slightly stands at the apex of this. He gave a very good Hugo Young speech at The Guardian about a year or so ago, where he said he had sort of the zeal of the convert, and now he was a decentraliser, and nothing really came from that, because answering big questions about how you're going to run the country whilst talking about decentralisation means you really have to buy into it. You absolutely have to make it part of your answer to every single fundamental question. And I'm not sure that Ed Miliband is quite in that space in the way that some others like John Crinnis and some others within the party are.
And so what does that fundamentally mean for what we could expect from a Labour government? Because as you say, there is this tension between centralisers and decentralisers at the top of the party. Mm. And clearly there's an issue about, certainly if you get into the realms of fiscal devolution, between a government that might seek to redistribute to parts of the country which are perhaps doing less well, if you have handed tax-raising powers and the retention of tax down to a city level, that, you know, you will be constrained in your ability to do that.
Exactly. And the Labour Party is a party that spent years in the 90s banging on about postcode lotteries and how bad postcode lotteries were, and that everybody should be in a position where they are entitled to the same level of care or service provision. Now, obviously, has a concern if you do devolve this kind of thing, and I certainly would like the Labour Party to devolve a hell of a lot more than it already does down to even the sort of community level, beyond cities, beyond local government, down to actual communities. You are going to get the risk of postcode lottery. So it's how you balance the Labour Party's urge to mark things on a grid that says you are X percent of your way through X project, you are here on a league table, you are hitting this benchmark, with an increased desire that I do think is a lot more important for a lot of people in the party now to try and devolve power. And it's power more than money. Like, you can keep a lot of the similar metrics in terms of where money goes, steering money towards areas of high poverty, high need, whilst also devolving power, because quite often what you find is that groups who feel disadvantaged in society aren't necessarily saying, give me more money. They're saying, I feel like I've got absolutely no control over my life whatsoever. I don't even get to make the most basic decision about how my life works, about how services work, about how my community works, if there is still any sense of community in a lot of places. And that sense of power more than money is, I think, where Labour can do quite interesting things if it's minded to.
I mean, it's what I'm interested in from what you said there most, I think, is this idea of a postcode lottery, and the idea that politicians, potentially of all parties, are frightened of that issue, you know, of that particular challenge being levelled at them. But it's a myth, isn't it? I mean, we have a postcode lottery now, and we're the most centralised country in the developed world. But I guess, nevertheless, there are political risks for anybody who is willing to stand up and advocate for different standards, different kinds of public service provision in different parts of the country. How do we get over that?
I think the Daily Mail has a lot to answer for on this one. Because one of the reasons we've ended up in the ridiculous situation where a single individual, the Secretary of State for Health, will be held responsible for everything that happens in any hospital anywhere in Britain if it goes wrong, is because we have a very big and powerful tabloid newspaper that will try and hold him responsible for it. So obviously that individual is going to try extremely hard to make sure they have the levers of power so they can stop these things happening. I think this has given our politicians a sort of allergy to letting go of control. But I do think there are also philosophical barriers on both left and right here. I mean, Mark has already talked about the Labour Party's difficulties with postcode lotteries and so on, and the fact the Labour Party as an institution is very committed to the idea of a national health service, a national welfare system. And that doesn't really sit that comfortably with the idea that different bits of the country would have different settlements. But there is a parallel problem on the right, I think, which is, if you go back to the days when we had a Greater London Council, that was abolished because it was doing things that the national government, the Conservative government, didn't like very much. And I don't think that tendency has entirely gone away. I mean, if you look at the schools policies conducted by this government over the last 5 years, a lot of the rhetoric was about devolving power to individual head teachers, but there was always a subtext of, we are going to give you power and this is what we expect you to do with it. And I'm not convinced that the entirety of the Conservative Party is ready for the implications of this kind of devolution either.
I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, David, is this essentially a policy agenda from the top of the Conservative Party? I mean, how far down within the Conservative Party itself is there enthusiasm for devolution and decentralisation in UK cities?
I think the devolution agenda over the past 5 years within the Conservative Party has been driven by a number of figures who are very enthusiastic about it. I mean, Greg Clark, obviously being one, and George Osborne, secondly, who by all accounts kind of came on board at a certain stage and then came on board in a really big way. And I think that that kind of leadership is really generating a space within the party now where these ideas are kicking about, and I think Conservatives are genuinely getting excited for devolution, and I think there are good kind of Conservative reasons for doing so. I mean, we were talking about postcode lottery earlier, and to a degree, there already is a postcode lottery in this country. In a way, we have the worst of all worlds, because we kind of have a postcode lottery, but in a sense, no one is kind of responsible for it, and therefore you can't really learn any lessons from it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a sense in which the idea that pushing power downwards and yielding differences in approach between different areas, which can then be compared and potentially competed, is a thoroughly kind of conservative way of approaching this, and a reason conservatives should be enthusiastic about this. You know, if Manchester is doing something well and Leeds isn't doing it well, you know, that's a kind of competitive pressure, which, you know, conservatives believe in the free market. You're replicating a good positive force there. So postcode lotteries, it's a very negative term, but it can create good positive pressures, which I feel are very kind of centre-right in character.
And that brings us back to a sense as well of thinking about the challenge you put forward before, David, as well, about improvements to public service provision through doing more decentralisation, more devolution. To what extent do you all feel that this is a conversation that's being had with a coherent, well thought through vision for what the state is going to be like in 3 to 5 years' time once we've seen this next round of public sector cuts? You know, is this part for any of the parties really of a reimagining of what the state is going to be in the next 5 to 10 years?
It sort of is by necessity, but we're very bad at this. I mean, let me rephrase that. We're very bad at designing systems that anyone would necessarily want to replicate, because we have a democracy that's been built up over hundreds of years and tinkered with, and the laws used to look like this and it looks like that, and devolution sort of was like this but now it's like that, and tax raising powers are like this over here and don't exist over here. And so now we have, you know, we're going to devolve power to a city region, but only one city region, and in a specific top-down way, but also includes the NHS, which is not something that we've talked about before, and it'll sort of link up with transport and how will that interact with other cities. And it's I think it's very positive for the people of Manchester, but are we expecting the people of Leeds, the people of Sheffield, the people of Bristol, the people of Birmingham to demand the same thing? I don't know. I mean, this also always feels like it's something that people are broadly in favour of if you suggest it to them, but never when I'm out knocking on doors at the Labour Party do people say to me, "Oh, do you know what I want, Mark? What I want is city regions. And if you don't deliver proper devolution to local authorities and to city regions and re-empower my local area, then frankly, you're not going to get my vote." So it's quite difficult because it's... But then again, if you say, would you like there to be more power in your local area? Would you like to say have a say over what services are provided in your town? People go, well, yes, obviously. Mm. So there is that framing there that's very important. But I think what arguably needs to happen is a complete reimagining of what the British state looks like and the British government looks like, from an individual up to central government. And I don't think anyone really has the appetite to do that at the moment, because that's messy.
And then moving on then to thinking about these issues as you've just put them there on the doorstep of an election campaign, all of the parties have pledged to do more in the next parliament, even if they're not getting to the stage of articulating a new vision for the state. How, John, in your view, do you think this is impacting on, you know, how parties are framing other mainstream issues, like housing, for example, which has been another big topic of the general election so far? Are we seeing, you know, a sufficient interaction between, on the one hand, a devolution agenda where we're accepting that places are different and need different things, versus what's often framed as a national crisis like housing that needs urgent action?
I think there are certain parallels with the housing issue, in that, in the same way, devolution is probably not coming up on the doorstep very much. I think people are saying, oh, we're worried about our kids being able to buy a house, but if you turn that round into a solid action, say, okay, would you like us to build on that bit of greenbelt over there? The answer is always going to be no. So we're kind of in a position where it's salient enough that politicians feel the need to talk about this stuff, but it's not salient enough to require solid plans that are actually going to change anything. I sometimes feel that we're kind of in the same position with the devolution debate, where, you know, everyone's kind of paying lip service to it, and I think, you know, there is genuine movement, as you can see in Manchester, but I don't think we're anywhere close to the kind of national settlement that's probably required to totally change the mindset, so that the assumption is not always that power is with the centre unless the centre says otherwise. The assumption is instead that power should be local unless they require a bigger solution. I'm not necessarily sure that it's going to climb any higher, devolution rather, I'm not necessarily sure it's going to climb any higher up the sort of list of voters' concerns than it is at the moment. Mm-hmm. It often feels to me like there is a conversation going on which includes certain people in each of the parties and many of the people in this room about how this is the solution to many of our problems. I don't necessarily think this is going to be penetrating to the electorate at large. I think this is a bit of a bubble issue, to be honest.
So, I mean, thinking about other key policy areas for the economy and for the development of other parts of the country, which we've established is at least one of the kind of key drivers for putting this issue on there so high up the political agenda. I mean, do we see what's being announced at the moment in Greater Manchester as something which is capable of driving economic growth in what were once Labour heartlands, or continue to be Labour heartlands, but which were once much more powerful parts of the UK economy?
The interesting thing about Manchester is it's arguably the most successful city region in the country outside London anyway. So it's sort of the easy win from a devolution point of view.
Well, it's the one which has the local leadership that works best together.
Sure.
From an economic point of view, there's a good case to be made that actually it's far from fulfilling its
potential. But I think there's also something culturally about Manchester as well. There was a great, I can't remember who wrote this, a great article a while ago that said, Manchester doesn't behave like it wants to be Britain's second city. It behaves like it wants to be Britain's first city. It has a level of sort of confidence and assuredness and swagger that perhaps is beyond its size. And I think there are only a certain number of cities in the country that have that sort of cultural, emotional, regional self-confidence. I do take on board what you say, though, about people getting on well together, the tale of most city regions, and actually a lot of the time when it's a lot of competing Labour Party authorities, has been there is invariably one council leader or one local authority who decide that they really should be more important in this sort of process than they're being given credit for, and the whole thing falls down. I don't need to name names.
So what? But I mean, what's the Labour plan for breaking some of that, parochial set of parochial attitudes? Because what we're really talking about here is plans to drive jobs and to increase wages. And if we're getting local political squads getting in the way of that, surely, you know, the Labour Party nationally needs to have a plan to start dealing with that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, unfortunately, the Labour Party's plan doesn't really deal with it. It sort of ignores that these parochial issues exist to a certain extent because it relies upon people being able to work together. And unfortunately, sometimes human nature gets in the way of that. I mean, some of the other ways in which it could be dealt with regional assemblies, it still has a level of popularity within the Labour Party because there's a feeling that it was never tried properly. But there's no realistic chance of that coming back onto the agenda again. So we are fixed on this. How do you get city regions to work together? How do you get local authorities to combine?
I mean, it always amazes me this, though, because I mean, we live in, on the one hand, the most centralised country in the Western world. Power is held within the centre. Mm. It is within the gift, surely, of national politicians to set a framework of incentives, carrots and sticks, to make sure that local politicians work together, isn't it?
But I think you're seeing evidence of that happening right now, though. Mm. I mean, new combined authorities coming into existence. I think the government has, whether it's been a kind of well-thought-through codified system of incentives, I don't know, but there have been actions on the part of central government which have spurred changes in local areas, which are the kind of changes you're talking about.
So I think we are seeing movement, yes.
I think the example of Manchester has probably encouraged a number of other cities to take this a bit more seriously. I think there is a certain amount of angst in the West Midlands about the fact they are basically losing their second city status to Manchester. Mm. But there is also kind of an interesting counterexample. If you look at what's happening across the Channel, France has had this sort of political process going on, but it's ended in basically just pressed a button and instantly created, I think it's 14 new city regions, which in the three largest, Paris, Marseille and Lyon, are you know, proper metropolitan regions with enormous amounts of power.
Yeah.
And then there's a slightly smaller version for the next tier of cities down. But they just decided to do that, and there was a parliamentary process, but nonetheless it ultimately ends with a piece of legislation that makes this happen. It's a big bang. There is something adorably French about that, the idea of having a sort of Napoleonic centralising attitude to devolution. But maybe that's the kind of thing that we would need to do here if we're going to have that kind of scale of change.
We sort of have that as well, don't we? I mean, we had dozens and dozens of votes for who wanted to have a mayor in their city, and then arguably the most impressive piece of devolution we're talking about is someone sat at the Treasury going, that bit of area marked out on the map, they're getting the mayor, they're getting extra powers.
Well, I think, and I think that, that speaks to the you know, the degree to which power is centralised in the country. Moving on, just to pick up a little bit more about the politics of UK cities. I mean, as I mentioned at the outset, you know, 2/3 of the top 50 target seats that have been identified are, in some senses, urban seats. We know that the geography of votes for the Labour Party, for the Liberal Democrats, the Conservatives, you know, is markedly different across the country. And actually, you've got you know, large swathes of the country which you know, are either beyond the Tory Party's reach as things stand, or beyond the Labour Party's reach as things stand. I'd be interested just to get your sense of where, you know, the urban agenda sits in that context as well, and in the need for parties to appeal to urban voters and be speaking about the issues that are most of concern to urban voters.
I mean, I think for the Labour Party it's absolutely essential, because slightly because of some of the Labour Party's historic failings on things like rural policy and a lack of sometimes doing enough work on rural and coastal areas, the Labour Party's electoral map is overwhelmingly, with a few exceptions, urban. The vast majority of people who Ed Miliband needs to vote for him to make him Prime Minister will either live or work, or most probably both, in a urban or suburban area. So it's absolutely essential, and that's borne out by Labour's 106 target seats. I've spent a lot of time travelling around the country interviewing candidates to see what the campaigns look like. Put it this way, I very rarely am finding myself very far from a major train station, because I'm going from town to town, not village to village.
And how does that compare to the Conservative picture, Dave?
I mean, the Conservatives definitely have a problem in urban areas. I mean, everyone's familiar with Conservative northern problem, but really the Conservative urban problem would probably be more accurate. So Policy Exchange pointed out quite recently that if you took the Trans-Pennine Express from Liverpool to Newcastle, 13 of your stops would be in Conservative areas and 19 in Labour, which is not too bad. The real issue is northern urban areas. I mean, what you do about that is much more difficult.
Yes.
You know, the things which people in urban areas care about are, by and large, the same things that people in non-urban areas care about. So, you know, I don't think there's any kind of specific urban recipe that the party needs to adopt. But I guess I would come back to what I was saying earlier, and I think the Conservative Party does need to ensure that it talks the language of cities. The grain of language should be the grain of Newcastle, Liverpool, Birmingham, because those are the places that people identify and kind of make sense of. And I think, yeah, I think that's a vital part of it.
And I mean, is this something which the Conservatives are taking seriously as part of their general election campaign and plan on the ground this time around? Are you expecting to see gains in 2015 within urban areas? Or is this a longer term modernising or you know, rebranding of the party in certain parts of the country?
I think in this election there's a resolute focus upon the key target seats, with resources being clearly very focused upon that. I think insofar as it is a kind of distinctively urban strategy, it is a longer term one.
Do you think it's fair, John, I mean, as I said at the outset, to think about this election in terms of urban battlegrounds, given the kind of context that Mark and David have set out there?
I'm not entirely sure I accept the premise, I have to say. I think one of the reasons that so many of the competitive seats are in urban areas is that this is a pretty urban country. And another is that the rural seats are by and large pretty safe Tory. So I think you kind of end up with most of the competitive seats being urban ones
almost by default.
Yeah. As to whether the Conservatives are taking the urban battle seriously, I think, as you know, a number of us have said by now, I think there is certainly moves afoot to try and make the party more competitive in the urban north again in the long term through the economic revival and so on. That's probably not going to have much of an impact over the next 2 months. And I think actually much of the pressure on Tory policymaking has been pulling it in the opposite direction. If you look, they've moved far more because of the threat of UKIP, which is not an urban vote at all. It's the exact opposite. All the things that matter to urban voters are the things that absolutely terrify UKIP. It's building more houses and making sure that, tolerance and so on. If you kind of come up with a sort of, you know, a black and white negative of the urban policy agenda, you would basically have the UKIP manifesto. They are almost exact opposites of each other. And that is the direction the Conservative Party has let itself get pulled in over the last 18 months.
I mean, I'd be keen to get your senses on the extent to which any of the parties really are playing beyond their base in this election, particularly in an urban kind of context. I mean, there are, you know, Mark, you mentioned, you know, the seats that need to be won if Ed Miliband's going to be Prime Minister. But what about those seats that are in urban areas but are on that target list and actually represent would represent gains for Labour?
I mean, the interesting thing for Labour is that it's got a very ambitious list of 606 target seats, which, I mean, even the most optimistic analysis of how Labour's going to do at this stage does not encompass Labour making 100 gains. Not least because of the impact of Scotland, but also that's just not where the polls are currently at. But the vast majority, I think there are only half a dozen, have been held by Labour, because Labour still has this overhang from, as in, at some point, 1997, 2001, 2005, at some point these were Labour seats, therefore on some sort of swing they can be again. So it slightly goes back to the fact that historically the Labour Party has just not been as good as it should be at campaigning in rural areas. So it is, on that sense, is Labour appealing to a base. Certainly what Labour is doing is trying to re-win seats that it's won before, which means that it's not necessarily learning all of the mistakes from the past, which includes there are rural seats where Labour could perform better. Labour does have policies, particularly in terms of agriculture, but also in terms of things that are much more modern and interesting perhaps than that, like rural broadband, interconnectivity, rural transport, that could help Labour do well in a lot of these seats, but for reasons of resource and real politic, they're never going to end up on the target seat list.
So if we then imagine that with the polls being the way that they are, it's at least a strong likelihood that we may end up with another coalition government of one kind or another. Obviously there are a number of parties in the mix of that, partly it depends on how the Liberal Democrats perform as well. What do we think another coalition arrangement would mean for urban policy? Do you think it would help make progress on this agenda, that we'd actually see decentralisation, devolution pushed forward as part of a new coalition agreement, perhaps like the localism agenda was in 2010? Or do you actually think, without strong leadership that perhaps a majority government could give, making real gains on this agenda would be more difficult? What do you think, John?
I tend towards the latter, more pessimistic position, I have to say. I think in a coalition situation, you could imagine a situation where it became, the result was so inconclusive that everybody agreed we basically needed a new constitutional settlement. We needed a kind of a big, wide offer to kind of make sure the next election was a total game changer. But I suspect that what actually happens is that the hard stuff and the contentious stuff kind of goes off the table a little bit. And I think there are, I don't think this actually, the idea of devolution actually sort of fits into an easy sort of left-right split. I think there are prominent people in all major parties who are very much in favour of devolution, and there are equally prominent people who think it's an absolutely terrible idea. And because in a coalition there is an extent to which everybody's kind of watching the extreme wings of their own party a little bit, I think. So I suspect it just gets put into the too difficult pile, but I don't know.
Well, how do you feel about that, Mark? Can you imagine a Lab-Lib coalition prioritising devolution in 2015 to 2020?
Yes, because I think that in such a situation, the difficulty for the Labour Party would be who's left from the Liberal Democrats. There would largely be Liberal Democrats for what you might call the sort of the edge of the country seats, the southwest, perhaps the north of Scotland. And they tend to be more economically and socially conservative than they're very much liberals, they're not social democrats on the whole. The overlap on policy terms with some of those people might be more towards a devolution of regional power, especially if the Liberal Democrats are effectively a party of the southwest and a couple of urban enclaves, then something which involves a massive devolution of power to regions, including the southwest, might be the best chance for the Liberal Democrats to retrench and build outwards from there. I do think, though, I think the problem is that for years, we had a lot of conversations in political circles that basically went, God, coalition, that's a bit of a shocker, isn't it? Don't worry, that'll never happen again. And now that is no longer the case. First past the post, the entire benefit of first past the post is meant to be that we don't get coalitions anymore. It's now a political system that has lost its entire reason for being to deliver strong, stable governments. I think perhaps we will have to have a real discussion. I mean, Labour has committed itself to a constitutional convention. Of course, like any political promise that's made at the moment, that only carries weight if A, Labour wins the election, and what does winning mean, and B, who any Miliband majority in Parliament would be made up of. I mean, would the Liberal Democrats want the constitutional convention? The SNP probably would, but not one that Ed Miliband would want. So it's very much up in the air, to be honest.
Would you echo that, David, from a Conservative point of view?
Yes, it's up in the air, but I guess I'd strike a note of optimism as well, maybe. I mean, there's always been, as you know, as John was saying earlier, I think there's always been, you know, localising tendencies within, you know, all of the major parties, you know, for decades, really. It's merely that the kind of ideas about what form that should take have shifted over time. And it seems to me that there is a kind of emerging consensus about what the recipients of this decentralised power should be, namely kind of around cities. And I think that has provided a certain momentum to the whole, the kind of broader decentralisation agenda. Whether that's sufficient in itself, I don't know, but I think that will still be there after the election.
I think my concern would be that we tend to default to the status quo in this country, not least because, you know, Whitehall quite likes the status quo, and Whitehall will have quite a lot of power in another coalition. But there is a secondary reason, I think, why a big devolutionary settlement is going to be quite difficult, which is that we talk a lot about city regions because you can kind of draw a line around an idea of Manchester or an idea of Leeds and so on. But once you get outside those big areas, it's not actually clear what you should be devolving to. And we have endless arguments in which some people are talking about devolution as kind of an economic imperative and some people are talking about identity. And it means they end up talking past each other and can't agree on what region we should be looking at. And so I suspect in that situation, nothing happens. I was at a fringe event at the Labour conference last year called Northern Democracy, Yes Please, where there was huge amounts of enthusiasm for the idea of a new settlement for the North, so that not everything was being run by Westminster. And within about 5 minutes, the whole thing had been derailed by people just yelling at each other about what that settlement should look like, because Leeds doesn't want to be run from Manchester, Carlisle doesn't want to be run from Manchester, the rural areas don't want to be forgotten, and the guys from the Campaign for an English Parliament won't shut up. Yeah. And it just, I suspect that if there's just people having that argument over and over again, nothing will happen, because the easiest thing to do will be nothing.
I mean, you're right, there are lots of parts of the country around which you can't just draw lines and segment them up nicely, but we're a long way off that still. I mean, it's basically only Manchester, there's still many areas where you can conceivably do that, and, you know, if we got even close to doing that in places like Leeds or Liverpool, you know, that would represent huge progress. So whilst, yes, we do eventually reach a point where you throw your hands up in the air and go, okay, where do I start devolving power to, I think, you know, that's always down the line.
The other thing that's difficult is it's a very unusual, I mean, to my mind, a fantastic but very unusual kind of politician who comes into politics, spends years working to build up a reputation within their party, get elected to parliament, rise throughout their party, reach the apex of their political power, and then starts giving it away to people hundreds of miles away who are going to quite often make decisions that they think are fundamentally wrong. Now, there are some politicians who believe that politics is about giving power to people, and that's a completely different kind of leadership to the way in which we've conventionally understood politics in Britain before, and it takes quite a brave person to have that approach. I think we've also got to talk about local, like the one sort of bit of government we haven't talked about here is the actual MPs. Like, if you are devolving power, what is the role of an MP if a huge proportion of what he is trying to achieve in his local area is delivered by somebody else? Should MPs be part of that power structure? Should they get a vote in local areas? Should they have some sort of say? Or should they be entirely Westminster-bound people who vote on national priorities and devolve parcels of money here and there to local communities, including their own?
Well, that's linked to the final issue that I wanted to pick up. probably. It strikes me as very interesting that in recent weeks we've seen in a couple of instances a kind of a new devolved politics and some of the tensions that can bring up. If you look earlier in this parliament, you saw it to a degree when the Conservative government's affordable housing reforms came in, and you had Boris Johnson, a Conservative mayor of London, actually talking about the impact of those being social cleansing within London, and very much being a vocal opponent of some of that agenda. Most recently, we've had the Labour mayoral candidates and the mansion tax and some of the tensions kind of thrown up by that. And then obviously the NHS devolution agreement, and then tensions between the National Labour Party and local Labour politicians. I'd be very keen to get reflections really on, well, if we actually do make progress on decentralisation and devolution to UK cities, does this transform the way we do politics in this country? Will we see more disagreements between national parties and local branches of that party? How do we begin to reconcile some of those so that we're not seeing, constant infighting within the major political parties as we know them at the moment?
I think there is certainly a tension of that sort. I think it's significant that both the mayors we've had in London have been figures who are, to a certain extent, stand slightly outside their party machine. And I imagine there will be more of that, because the pressures you are under as a city politician are going to be different to those you're under as a national politician. And they also have their own mandate. And, unlike a council leader, Boris Johnson is, I think I'm right in saying, he's got the biggest mandate of any politician in Western Europe. If you look at the size of his electorate.
Second after French president.
Apologies, yes.
Very good.
So second, but nonetheless, it remains that, he kind of is in a position where he is capable of speaking up to the party leadership and saying, no, this is the wrong position for London. I think we would obviously end up seeing more of that if there was more devolution. What impact that has on the system of Westminster, you have to ask someone else, I'm afraid.
Well, Mark, you've been, or you were vocally critical of some of the responses from the London mayoral candidates, for example, on the mansion tax and this idea that they were undermining the National Party's platform. How, if we see more devolution, how do you resolve that kind of thing?
I think it all boils down to leadership and what leadership looks like. For me, leadership and standing up for your city does not mean talking about 100,000 people within a city of nearly 10 million people and focusing on their concerns and damaging your party and the potential for your party to win crucial seats in London by doing so. For me, leadership is a bit more than just saying, this affects some people in my city, therefore I oppose it. Mm-hmm. I think you need to have a much more, especially a city the size of London, being reactively against anything that may hit anyone in your city because of that is quite electorally and politically, to my mind, stupid. Never mind the policy around that. But there are particular challenges for the Labour Party in terms of devolution. Now, Andy Burnham has been very happy about the NHS devolution in Manchester. Now, that was it looked a little bit like an ambush to me. This is Andy Burnham's issue, the NHS, in Andy Burnham's backyard, the Northwest, discussed with people, including Andy Burnham's own council leader, and at no point did Andy Burnham find out about this until it was announced. So I can sort of see why he wasn't best pleased. However, if it's good for Manchester and it works, then it's very hard to oppose. Surely the argument that needs to be made is not, this is bad and I will repeal it, but I have these concerns, I will deal with these concerns if I'm the Health Secretary, and how do we roll this out in a way that works for other regions across the country?
And from a Conservative point of view, David, we've had Boris Johnson, Mayor of London, for some time now. As John has said, somewhat, he's a figure who sits somewhat outside of the party machinery in many respects. How has it felt from a Conservative point of view to have, to a degree a maverick leading London, but from a Conservative point of view, often not shy of criticising his own party's policy platforms?
Boris is such a unique politician that it's almost like he kind of creates his own rules as he's going. What the effect would be if you had, numbers of Boris's across the country? That would be quite something. But, Both Mark and John, are right. If you push power down, inevitably you are going to create greater fragmentation. It's harder to keep a single party line. But maybe some of that is a good thing. Maybe a certain amount of dissent within a given political party, especially where those representatives seem to be sticking up for a city. I mean, from a Conservative Party point of view, for example, if you had, say, a Conservative mayor in Leeds, maybe it's going to be good for the party's long-term aspirations if you have someone standing up against the party and saying, no, this is right for my city. And again, it kind of comes back to what I was saying earlier about parties being able to connect with particular places. So dissent may have certain benefits as well in that regard.
We also see people representing parties you wouldn't expect to represent certain cities, or perhaps people of no parties. You've got George Ferguson in Bristol. I mean, looking at that seat, you would say Labour holds a lot of the parliamentary seats, Labour has the majority of the councillors, Labour's looking to win some of these seats back in the 2015 general election. It should have been a Labour win, but it wasn't. Similarly, London is, by most standards on polling, on council seats, on parliamentary seats, more than Labour city, the Tory city. Boris Johnson's it's won twice. I think it has the potential to break down some of these silos of this is a Labour area, this is a Tory area, this is a Lib Dem area. But also, there are massive advantages for local communities and for political parties of devolution, because there are parts of the country. Whitney is always going to elect a Conservative MP. Blaine is always going to vote for a Labour MP. But people who don't live in either of these places but decide which government Whitney and Blaine and Cardiff and Sheffield get. Whereas if you devolve power, then in some of these one-party states, you at least get some of that power being held at a local level and far more accountably.
I am conscious that I've been quite Eeyore-ish for a lot of this discussion. Every time you've asked me if I'm optimistic, the answer is no. I should say that I do think there is kind of a sort of an urban moment going on outside Britain, of which this is a part. I mean, for the first time, I think we're getting cities around the world talking to each other about how to solve common problems. And one of the reasons why this has appeared on the British agenda is because of Jim O'Neill, who's the ex Goldman Sachs economist, who's the guy who kind of came up with, from George Osborne's point of view, at least he popularised the idea of a Northern powerhouse and kind of got it onto the political agenda. But he got that because he was looking at how other cities around the world work. Mm. So I suspect that even if we don't get the big devolutionary offer in the aftermath of this election, I don't think the issue is going to go away, and I don't think the centralisation of the British state, as it's been for the last two generations, is sustainable in the long term.
Well, that's all we've got time for. I'd like to thank my guests, David Kirkby, Mark Ferguson and John Elledge. You've been listening to City Talks.
Thank you for listening to City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding city economies. For more on our research and events programme, please visit centreforcities.org.